Chapter 9. Meaning. In the early winter of 1942, Austrian authorities in Vienna rounded up and arrested hundreds of Jews, among them a young psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl. At the time, Frankl was a rising figure in his field who was developing a new theory of psychological well-being. He and his wife Tilly had anticipated the roundup, so they took pains to preserve what was then their most important possession. Before the police marched into their home, Tilly sewed into the lining of Victor's coat the manuscript of the book he was writing about his theories. Victor wore the coat when the couple was later dispatched to Auschwitz. He clung to it his first day in the concentration camp. But on day two, the SS guards stripped him down, confiscated all his clothing, and Frankl never saw the manuscript again. Over the next 3 years, at Auschwitz and later at Dachau, as his wife, brother, mother, and father perished in the gas ovens, Frankl worked to recreate his text by scratching notes on stolen scraps of paper. And in 1946, 1 year after Allied forces liberated the concentration camps, those crumpled bits of paper formed the basis of what would become one of the most powerful and enduring works of the last century, Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. In Man's Search for Meaning, Frankl describes how he persevered in the face of crushing labor, sadistic guards, and scant food. But his book is more than a narrative of survival. It is both a window into the human soul and a guide to a meaningful life. Drawing on his own experiences in the camps, as well as the experiences and mental states of his fellow prisoners, Frankl elaborated the theory he had begun before his arrest. He argues that man's main concern is not to gain pleasure or to avoid pain, but rather to see a meaning in his life. Our fundamental drive, the motivational engine that powers human existence, is the pursuit of meaning. Frankl called his approach logotherapy, for logos, the Greek word for meaning, and it quickly became an influential movement in psychotherapy. Frankl and others managed to find meaning and purpose even in the unimaginably ghastly setting of a concentration camp. He demonstrates that meaning is possible in spite of suffering, indeed that meaning can sometimes grow from suffering. But he also emphasizes that suffering is not a prerequisite to finding meaning. The search for meaning is a drive that exists in all of us, and a combination of external circumstances and internal will can bring it to the surface. This last point is key to the book and to its relevance today. In the early years of the 21st century, several forces have gathered to create the circumstances for the pursuit of meaning on a scale never before imagined. First, while problems of poverty and other social maladies persist, most people in the advanced world have been relieved from true suffering. As I laid out in Chapter 2, we live in an era of abundance, with standards of living unmatched in the history of the world. Freed from the struggle for survival, we have the luxury of devoting more of our lives to the search for meaning. Surely, if Frankl and his fellow prisoners could pursue meaning from the work camps of Auschwitz, we can do the same from the comfort of our abundant lives. Other forces are also at work. As I mentioned in Chapter 3, the mammoth baby boom generation is reaching a demographic milestone. The typical boomer now has more of his life behind him than ahead of him, prompting the searching of souls and the reevaluation of priorities. The specter of terrorism hovers, offering reminders of life's fleetingness and raising questions of its purpose. Meantime, technology continues its unrelenting march, deluging us with data and choking us with choices. All these forces have gathered into a perfect storm of circumstances that is making the search for meaning more possible and the will to find meaning the sixth essential aptitude of the conceptual age. Robert William Fogel, the Nobel laureate economist I mentioned briefly in Chapter 2, calls this moment the Fourth Great Awakening. He writes, "Spiritual or immaterial inequity is now as great a problem as material inequity, perhaps even greater." His words echo Frankl's a half century earlier. People have enough to live, but nothing to live for. They have the means, but no meaning. Ronald Engelhardt, a respected political scientist at the University of Michigan, who has been tracking and comparing public opinion in dozens of countries for the last quarter century, has detected a similar yearning. Each time he administers his World Values Survey, he finds that respondents express greater concern for spiritual and immaterial matters. For instance, according to one recent survey, 58% of Americans say they think often about the meaning and purpose of life. Substantial, though lower, percentages of Germans, British, and Japanese report the same. Engelhardt believes that the advanced world is in the midst of a slow change in its operating principles, what he calls a gradual shift from materialist values, emphasizing economic and physical security above all, toward post-materialist priorities, emphasizing self-expression and the quality of life. Greg Easterbrook, an American journalist who has written insightfully on this topic, puts it more boldly. A transition from material want to meaning want is in progress on an historically unprecedented scale, involving hundreds of millions of people, and may eventually be recognized as the principal cultural development of our age. Whatever we call it, the Fourth Great Awakening, post-materialist values, meaning want, the consequences are the same. Meaning has become a central aspect of our work and our lives. Pursuing meaning obviously is no simple task. You can't buy a cookbook with a recipe for it, or open a packet of powder and add water and stir. But there are two practical, whole-minded ways for individuals, families, and businesses to begin the search for meaning. Start taking spirituality seriously, and start taking happiness seriously. Taking spirituality seriously. A little man in a burgundy robe and red sneakers is the last to take the stage. As he emerges from the wings, the audience stands in hushed reverence. He smiles a beatific smile, greets the others, and sits cross-legged on the empty armchair that's waiting for him. The man I'm squinting at from the back rows of a packed 1,300-seat auditorium on the campus of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the man who's caused all these people, including Richard Gere, hands pressed together namaste style, and Goldie Hawn, hands wiggling by her side, to rise and revere, is the 14th manifestation of the Buddha of Compassion, a.k.a. the Dalai Lama, winner of the Nobel Prize, leader in exile of Tibet, and spiritual rock star who the next evening will fill Boston's Fleet Center with some 13,000 adoring fans. What is the Dalai Lama doing at MIT? He's here for the Investigating the Mind conference, a two-day gab fest about what science can learn from Buddhism and what Buddhism can learn from science. Each morning and afternoon, the chairs on stage will fill with scientists wearing professorial earth tones and monks wearing rich shades of red and saffron, a visual display of reason breaking bread with spirit, of the left and right sides of our collective brains meeting in the middle. 15 years ago, the Dalai Lama began inviting scientists to his home in Dharamsala, India. He was interested in what they were learning about the brain, and they were curious about what was going on in the brains of people who have developed an almost superhuman capacity for meditation and spiritual transcendence. Over the next decade and a half, scientists such as the University of Wisconsin's Richard Davidson began sliding monks into MRI machines like the one I entered in Chapter 1 to capture images of their meditating brains and to make new insights into emotion, attention, mental imagery, and other cognitive capacities. Monks such as Matthew Ricard, who originally trained as a molecular biologist, began reading scientific papers to understand the workings of the mind and perhaps the nature of the soul. The meeting that I attended was their first public gathering, a coming-out party of sorts. Science and Buddhism are very similar, the Dalai Lama told some of us at a press conference before the main event, because they are exploring the nature of reality, and both have the goal to lessen the suffering of mankind. What happened at the conference, lots of talk, plans for future research, is less significant, perhaps, than that it happened. Even MIT is taking spirituality seriously. As the well-known molecular biologist Eric Lander told the crowd, science is merely one way to understand the world. Across many different realms, there's a growing recognition that spirituality, not religion necessarily, but the more broadly defined concern for the meaning and purpose of life, is a fundamental part of the human condition. Indeed, our capacity for faith, again, not religion per se, but the belief in something larger than ourselves, may be wired into our brains. Perhaps not surprisingly, this wiring seems to run through the brain's right hemisphere. For example, Michael Persinger, a neuroscientist at Ontario's Laurentian University, has conducted somewhat controversial experiments with a device that's come to be called a God helmet. Persinger fastens the helmet onto subjects' heads and bathes their brain's right hemispheres in a weak field of electromagnetic radiation. Most of those who have strapped on the apparatus report feeling either the presence of God or a oneness with the universe, suggesting, again, that spiritual and mystical thoughts and experiences may be part of our neurophysiology. Meantime, at the University of Pennsylvania, Andrew Newberg has scanned the brains of nuns when they have meditated to the point of religious ecstasy and connection with God. His images show that during such moments, the part of the brain that guides a sense of self is less active, thus contributing to the feeling of being unified with something larger. Their work, and the work of others, has given rise to a new field, neurotheology, which explores the relationship between the brain and spiritual experience. As Caltech neuroscientist Stephen Quartz puts it, studies of our biological constitution make it increasingly clear that we are social creatures of meaning who crave a sense of coherence and purpose. At the very least, we ought to take spirituality seriously because of its demonstrated ability to improve our lives, something that might even be more valuable when so many of us have satisfied and oversatisfied our material needs. For instance, some of the maladies of modern life, stress, heart disease, and so on, can be allayed by attending to the spirit. People who pray regularly have been shown to have lower blood pressure on average than those who don't, according to research at Duke University. Johns Hopkins researchers have found that attending religious services cut people's risk of death from heart disease, suicide, and some cancers. Other research has found that women to whom life's meaning and purpose was central had higher levels of the types of cells that attack viruses and some kind of cancer cells. Still other studies have found that the belief that life has some higher purpose can buffer people from heart disease. According to a study at Dartmouth College, one predictor of survival among open-heart patients was how much patients relied on faith and prayer. People who go to church, or synagogue, or a mosque, regularly seem to live longer than those who don't, even controlling for a host of biological and behavioral variables. This is tricky and controversial territory, in part because so many charlatans have invoked the power of God to heal the infirm. If you depend on spirituality alone to battle cancer or to mend broken bones, you deserve the disastrous results that will follow. But a whole-minded approach, L-directed reason combined with R-directed spirit, can be effective. As I noted in Chapter 3, more than half of American medical schools now have courses in spirituality and health. According to Newsweek, 72% of Americans say they would welcome a conversation with their physician about faith. That's one reason some doctors have even begun taking spiritual histories of patients, asking them whether they seek solace in religion, whether they're part of a community of faith, and whether they see a deeper meaning in their lives. It can be a delicate topic, of course, but as Duke University's Dr. Harold Koenig told Religion News Service, we're at the place we were 20 years ago when doctors were asked to take a sexual history. Koenig estimates that between 5 and 10% of U.S. physicians take some form of spiritual history. Like narrative medicine, this merging of spirit and health is part of a more sweeping trend in medicine to treat each patient as a whole person rather than as a receptacle for a particular illness. One other field that has begun to take spirituality more seriously is business. If the conceptual age is flowering with post-materialist values and deepening our meaning want, it makes sense that the phenomenon would take root in the place where many of us spend most of our waking hours. 5 years ago, Ian Mitroff, a professor at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business, and Elizabeth Denton, a consultant, published a report called A Spiritual Audit of Corporate South America. After interviewing nearly 100 executives about spirituality in the workplace, they reached some surprising conclusions. Most of the executives defined spirituality in much the same way, not as religion, but as the basic desire to find purpose and meaning in one's life. Yet the executives were so understandably concerned that the language of spirit in the workplace would offend their religiously diverse employees that they scrubbed their vocabulary of all such talk. Meanwhile, Mitroff and Denton discovered, the employees were hungering to bring their spiritual values, and thus their whole person rather than one compartment of themselves, to work, but didn't feel comfortable doing so. Read this report and you can almost picture a river of meaning and purpose welling up outside corporate headquarters. But here's the kicker. If that spiritual tide had been released, the companies might have been better off. Mitroff and Denton also found that companies that acknowledged spiritual values and aligned them with company goals outperformed those that did not. In other words, letting spirituality into the workplace didn't distract organizations from their goals. It often helped them reach those goals. As more companies grasp this idea, we are likely to see a rise in spirit in business, a growing demand from individuals for workplaces that offer meaning as well as money. According to one recent U.S. survey, more than 3 out of 5 adults believe a greater sense of spirituality would improve their own workplace. Likewise, 70% of respondents to British think tank Rafi Park's annual management survey said they wanted their working lives to be more meaningful. And in the last few years, groups such as the Association for Spirit at Work and events such as the annual International Spirit in Business Conference have emerged. We'll also see a continued rise in spirit as business, commercial ventures that help a meaning-seeking population slake its craving for transcendence. Recall the candle industry of Chapter 2. Or think about the proliferation of yoga studios, evangelical bookstores, and green products, from the Toyota Prius to the cosmetics of the body shop. Rich Karlgaard, the savvy publisher of Forbes magazine, says this is the next cycle of business. First came the quality revolution of the 1990s. Then came what Karlgaard calls the cheap revolution, which dramatically reduced the cost of goods and allowed people around the world to have access to mobile phones and internet access. So what's next? Here's what Karlgaard thinks. Meaning, purpose, deep life experience. Use whatever word or phrase you like, but know that consumer desire for these qualities is on the rise. Remember your Abraham Maslow and your Viktor Frankl. Bet your business on it. Taking happiness seriously. Happiness, Viktor Frankl wrote, cannot be pursued. It must ensue. But from what does it ensue? That question has vexed humankind since a humankind was around to be vexed. But now the field of psychology has begun to provide some answers, thanks largely to the work of Martin E.P. Seligman, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and founder of the positive psychology movement. For most of its history, academic psychology focused on everything except happiness. It studied disease, disorder, and dysfunction, and largely ignored what made people satisfied and fulfilled. But when Seligman took the helm of the American Psychological Association in 1998, he slowly began guiding the ship of psych in a new direction. Seligman's research, as well as that of many other scientists who have turned their attention to satisfaction and well-being, has begun to unlock the secrets of what makes people happy, and to encourage the wider world to take happiness seriously. According to Seligman, happiness derives from a mix of factors. Part of it depends on biology. We're all born with a relatively fixed natural range of well-being imprinted on our genes. Some of us tilt toward the gloomy end of the spectrum, others toward the cheery end. But all of us can learn how to reach the upper portions of our individual range, where happiness can ensue. Among the things that contribute to happiness, according to Seligman, are engaging in satisfying work, avoiding negative events and emotions, being married, and having a rich social network. Also important are gratitude, forgiveness, and optimism. What doesn't seem to matter much at all, according to the research, are making more money, getting lots of education, or living in a pleasant climate. Marshalling these elements can help create what Seligman calls the pleasant life, a life full of positive emotions about the past, present, and future. But the pleasant life is only one rung on the hedonic ladder. At a higher level is what Seligman calls the good life, in which you use your signature strengths, what you're great at, to achieve gratification in the main areas of your life. This can turn what Studs Terkel called a Monday to Friday sort of dying into a calling. A calling is the most satisfying form of work because as gratification, it is done for its own sake rather than for the material benefits it brings, says Seligman. Enjoying the resulting state of flow on the job will soon, I predict, overtake material reward as the principal reason for working. The good life is good for business, too. More happiness causes more productivity and higher income, Seligman writes. There's even an emerging school of management thought built around the tenets of positive psychology. But the good life is not the ultimate. Seligman says there's a third form of happiness, and that's the pursuit of meaning, knowing what your highest strengths are and deploying them in the service of something larger than you are, Seligman says. Going beyond the self in this fashion is not much different from what those meditating nuns and monks were doing. And as rising prosperity and abundance allow more people to engage in this pursuit, and as more of us summon the will to do so, meaning will move to the center of our lives and our consciousness. One of the best-selling business books of the last decade has been a thin little volume with a strange title. Who Moved My Cheese is a business fable that has sold millions of copies around the world. The book tells the tale of Hem and Haw, two mouse-like critters who live in a maze and love cheese. One day, after years of finding their cheese in the same place, Hem and Haw awaken to find their precious cheddar gone. Somebody, yes, has moved their cheese. Hem and Haw react differently to this discovery. Hem, the whiny mouseling, wants to wait until somebody puts the cheese back. Haw, the anxious but realistic mouseling, wants to venture into the maze to discover new cheese. In the end, Haw convinces Hem that they should take action to solve their problem rather than wait for the solution magically to appear. And the micelings live happily ever after, or at least until their cheese moves again. The moral of the story is that change is inevitable, and when it happens, the wisest response is not to wail or whine, but to suck it up and deal with it. I don't disagree with the message of Who Moved My Cheese, but I do take issue with the metaphor. In the conceptual age, Asia and automation may constantly be moving our cheese, so to speak. But in an age of abundance, we're no longer in a maze. Today, the more appropriate metaphor for our times is the labyrinth. Mazes and labyrinths are often lumped together in the popular imagination, but they differ in important ways. A maze is a series of compartmentalized and confusing paths, most of which lead to dead ends. When you enter, your objective is to escape as quickly as you can. A labyrinth is a spiral walking course. When you enter, your goal is to follow the path to the center, stop, turn around, and walk back out, all at whatever pace you choose. Mazes are analytic puzzles to be solved. Labyrinths are a form of moving meditation. Mazes can be disorienting. Labyrinths can be centering. You can get lost in a maze. You can lose yourself in a labyrinth. Mazes engage the left brain. Labyrinths free the right brain. There are now more than 4,000 public and private labyrinths in the United States. They are surging in popularity for many of the reasons I've discussed in this chapter and in the rest of this audiobook. In an age when many Americans are looking beyond the church pulpit for spiritual experience and solace, a growing number have rediscovered the labyrinth as a path to prayer, introspection, and emotional healing, reports the New York Times. You can find them everywhere, in downtown squares in Switzerland, village greens in England, public parks from Indiana to Washington State to Denmark, universities in Northern California, jails in Southern California, and at houses of worship such as Riverside Church in Manhattan, the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., Methodist churches in Albany, a Unitarian church in San Jose, and a synagogue in Houston. And labyrinths are showing up at hospitals and other medical facilities. I happened to walk one of those kinds of labyrinths not too long ago at the Bayview Medical Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. This labyrinth is composed of 4-inch by 4-inch brick squares. 8 concentric circles formed from similar-sized white squares orbit a center space that's roughly 2 feet in diameter. Along the outer edge, a few squares have single words stamped onto them. Create, faith, wisdom, believe. Visitors often choose one of these words and then repeat it like a mantra in meditation as they circle to the center. I began my labyrinth walk by heading left and walking through the first ring. As I looked around, I saw a few medical center buildings on one side and a parking lot on the other. Nothing transcendent about this. It felt as if I was simply walking in a circle. So I started again. To avoid distractions, I looked down. I focused my sight on the 2 curving lines that formed the outline of my path, and I began walking, as slowly as I possibly could. The lines curled around me, and after a while, it felt a bit like driving on a long, empty road. I didn't have to pay much attention, so my mind slipped to a different place. And that had an unexpected calming effect. The experience, perhaps not surprisingly, was similar to the drawing course of Chapter 6 and the laughing club of Chapter 8. It jammed my powers of L-directed thinking. A labyrinth is an escape for the right brain, says David Tolsman, who designed and built the Johns Hopkins Labyrinth. As the left brain engages in the logical progression of walking the path, the right brain is free to think creatively. The person who most put labyrinths on the cultural map is Dr. Lauren Artress, an Episcopal priest at Grace Cathedral Church in San Francisco. A few years ago, she traveled to Chartres Cathedral in France, site of a 42-foot diameter labyrinth etched into the floor of the nave. When she visited, the labyrinth was covered with chairs and hadn't been used for 250 years. Artress removed the chairs, walked the labyrinth, and then imported the concept to the United States. She installed two now popular labyrinths at Grace Cathedral, and she set up a ministry that provides training and labyrinth kits to churches and other organizations. We live in such a left-brain world, and here's this whole other world that we must integrate in order to meet the challenges of the next century, Artress has said. When people walk into a labyrinth, they shift consciousness from the linear to the nonlinear and bring to the surface the deep, intuitive pattern part of ourselves. That experience is different from the experience of being in a maze, she says. It takes you into an entirely different part of your being than that problem-solving, I hope I make it feeling. Even the shape of the typical labyrinth is significant. The circle is the archetype for wholeness or unity. So when people walk into the labyrinth, they begin to see their whole life, Artress says. About 40 hospitals and medical centers now have labyrinths, for many of the same reasons that empathy and narrative have begun infiltrating the medical world. There's a growing recognition that the analytical approach to healing, while absolutely necessary, is not always sufficient, and that approaches once dismissed as woo-woo suggestions from New Age whack jobs can help patients get better. That whole-minded thinking led to the labyrinth at Johns Hopkins, one of the finest medical facilities in the world. Its organizers wanted a place where patients, their families, and the medical staff could go to find physical and mental relaxation. It may be working. At the labyrinth site are two weathered yellow notebooks in which people who have walked the labyrinth can write their thoughts. The notebooks testify to the solace and sense of meaning the labyrinth brings. Doctors and nurses write of coming here after challenging or harrowing experiences. Families of people undergoing surgery describe coming here to pray, to think, and to distract themselves. And in the notebook are moving stories written by patients themselves, entries like this one, which was written just a few days before I arrived. I join in the spirit of all those who have walked the labyrinth and have written on these pages. For me, my surgery 1 week ago today is the beginning of a new phase of life. My word as I walked the labyrinth was, believe. I believe in a new future. Labyrinths won't save the world, of course. Neither will any of the six senses I've described in this book. Making the transition from the information age to the conceptual age, moving from a landscape of L-directed thinking to one of R-directed thinking, adding the capacity for art and heart to our penchant for logic and analysis won't be easy. Few worthwhile things ever are. But maybe that's the point. As Viktor Frankl could have told us, the ideal life is not a fear-fueled pursuit of cheese. It's more like walking a labyrinth, where the purpose is the journey itself. Meaning Portfolio. Say thanks. Gratitude works. Feelings of gratitude enhance well-being and deepen one's sense of meaning. That's why Martin Seligman, whose work I described earlier in this chapter, advocates the gratitude visit. It works like this. You think of a person in your life who has been kind or generous to you, but whom you've never properly thanked. You write a detailed gratitude letter to that person, explaining in concrete terms why you're grateful. Then you visit that person and read the letter aloud. According to Seligman, the ritual is quite powerful. Everyone cries when you do a gratitude visit. It's very moving for both people. Seligman's research, as well as the work of the growing ranks of scholars who study positive psychology, suggests that gratitude is a key component of personal happiness. People who are grateful about specific things in their past, who dwell on the sweet triumphs instead of the bitter disappointments, tend to be more satisfied about the present. Seligman says the gratitude visit can be an effective way to increase the intensity, duration, and frequency of positive memory. One reason to give the gratitude visit a try is that it can generate a momentum of its own. Those who are thanked often then start to consider who in their own lives they never thanked. So they make their own pilgrimage, as eventually do the recipients of their thanks, resulting in a daisy chain of gratitude and contentment. Two variations on this theme are the birthday gratitude list and the gratitude one a day. The birthday gratitude list is simple. Once a year, on your birthday, make a list of the things for which you're grateful, with the number of items equaling the number of years you're turning that day. When I did this on my 40th birthday, my gratitude list included everything from red wine to the fact that my children are healthy to living in a free country. Your list will grow by one each year, the theory being that the older you get, the more you have to be thankful for. Keep your lists and review them each birthday. It will bring a sense of satisfaction that can soothe the anxiety of time's passage. The gratitude one a day is a way to weave thankfulness into your daily routine. Each day, at a certain moment, think of one thing for which you're grateful. Some people do this when they're about to go to sleep. Others do it to accompany some existing routine, when they drink a cup of coffee in the morning, when they make their bed, when they take their first step outside. These gratitude exercises might sound a little touchy-feely to some of you. Give them a try anyway. I guarantee you'll thank me. Take the 2010 test. I heard this exercise from Jim Collins, author of the blockbuster book, Good to Great. He encourages people to look at their lives, in particular their work, and ask themselves whether they would still do what they're doing now if they had $20 million in the bank or knew they had no more than 10 years to live. For instance, if you inherited $20 million, no strings attached, would you spend your days the way you spend them now? If you knew you had at most 10 years to live, would you stick with your current job? If the answer is no, that ought to tell you something. This test alone obviously can't determine your life course, but the approach is smart and the answers can be clarifying. Another exercise. This one's called Butt Out. Do you know what would make your life more meaningful, yet you find yourself stymied by the obstacles standing in your way? Break through those roadblocks with this simple exercise. Compile a list of some of the important changes you'd like to make in your life and what's keeping you from realizing them. I'd like to spend a lot more time with my family, but I travel a lot for my job. I'd like to eat better, but I'm surrounded at work by sugary snacks. I'd like to read more, but I rarely have time when I can sit down with a book. Now go back to each item and replace the word but with the word and. I'd like to spend more time with my family, and I travel a lot for my job, so I need to find ways to bring my family along during some of my travels. I'd like to eat better, and I'm surrounded at work by sugary snacks, so I need to pack my own supply of more healthful snacks to reduce my temptation to eat the bad stuff. I'd like to read more, and I rarely have time when I can sit down with a book, so I need to download some audiobooks that I can listen to in the car or at the gym. Exchanging and for but can move you out of excuse-making mode and into problem-solving mode. It's grammar's way of saying, deal with this. And if this technique fails, you can always say, I wanted to make changes in my life, but that exercise in Pink's audiobook didn't help me enough. Take a Sabbath. Select one day a week and remove yourself from the maw. Stop working. Don't answer your email. Ignore your voicemail. Turn off your mobile phone. Most Western religions have established a Sabbath, the seventh day of the week, as a time of peace, reflection, and prayer. Whatever your faith, consider experimenting with this practice. And this need not be religious at all. Secular Sabbaths can be equally re-energizing. For guidance, check out Wayne Muller's book, Sabbath, Finding Rest, Renewal, and Delight in Our Busy Lives. If committing to this weekly ritual isn't right for you, consider Muller's alternative. Choose one common act during your day to serve as a Sabbath pause. Whenever you say, grasp a doorknob or reach for the telephone, simply stop, take 3 mindful breaths, and then go through the door or answer the phone. Sabbaths, however momentary, can be important punctuation marks in our busy lives. Read these books. Recommending books about meaning is difficult. Much of the world's great literature tackles the topic of what meaning is and how to find it. So the following book recommendations don't trump great novels or sacred books. Read the Sermon on the Mount, sections of the Torah, and parts of the Quran, too, if you'd like. But for more secular, contemporary, and prescriptive guides to meaning, consider any of these fine books. Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Simply one of the most important books you'll ever read. Authentic Happiness by Martin E.P. Seligman. It astonishes me that more people haven't read this book and absorbed its lessons. It's an ideal introduction to positive psychology and contains all sorts of exercises to help you put the findings into action in your own life. For more information, check out Seligman's website, www.authentichappiness.org. Flow by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Flow, when you're so absorbed and enthralled in an activity that you lose your sense of time and place, is an important component in the aptitude of meaning. This book is your guide. What Should I Do With My Life? By Poe Bronson. That's a question all of us have asked ourselves, and it's one that Bronson got hundreds of people around the United States to ask themselves. He returned with a trove of moving, inspiring, and insightful stories. Mindfulness by Ellen Langer. Too many of us stumble through life mindlessly, says Harvard professor Langer. We're stuck in routines and unaware of our surroundings. Breaking out of that mindset, she says, can be the pathway to creativity and meaning. The Art of Happiness by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Howard C. Cutler, M.D. The Dalai Lama visits with physician Cutler and, in a series of interviews, explains his philosophy of life and expands on his idea that the very purpose of life is to seek happiness. Two related books are also excellent. The Art of Happiness at Work, another Dalai Lama-Dr. Cutler collaboration, extends Buddhist happiness principles into the office. Destructive Emotions is a fascinating scientific dialogue with the Dalai Lama that Daniel Goleman conducted during a Mind and Life conference in 2000. Visit a labyrinth. I've tried meditating and did a pretty bad job of it. I've considered yoga, but physically at least, I'm not very flexible. However, I've found labyrinths to be surprisingly addicting, so much so that I'd consider installing one in some future backyard. The advantage to me, short attention span, inability to sit still, is that labyrinths require movement, and moving meditation can be calming and centering. To find a labyrinth, start with these websites. The Labyrinth Society, www.labyrinthsociety.org. Known as TLS, this group operates a site with a wealth of information on labyrinths. The site also has its own shorter list of labyrinths, as well as a few nifty virtual labyrinths. Here you can also access the World Labyrinth Locator, where you can type in your city and country and find the labyrinth nearest you. Labyrinthos, www.labyrinthos.net. This is a British resource center for all things labyrinthine and a good source for labyrinths in the United Kingdom. To learn more about labyrinths, two books are worth perusing. Walking a Sacred Path by Lauren Artress, and the photo-heavy Labyrinths and Mazes by German photographer Jürgen Homuth. If you end up catching the labyrinth bug, you can find all sorts of portable labyrinths and labyrinth construction kits. One of the best websites for such products is the Labyrinth Company, www.labyrinthcompany.com, which designed the labyrinth I walked at Johns Hopkins. If you're not ready to plow a unicircular pathway into your lawn, consider a wooden finger labyrinth, a palm or lap-sized item in which you walk the labyrinth by tracing the grooved paths with your finger. They're oddly soothing and don't require leaving your home or office. For more information, go to Relax for Life, relax the numeral 4, then life.com. Check your time. Most of us can rattle off the things we consider most important. But does the reality of our daily lives match the rhetoric of our deepest aspirations? Find out with this exercise, a favorite of life coaches and time management gurus. First, make a short list of what is most important to you, the people, the activities, and the values. Pare the list to 10 or fewer items. Next, take your PDA, day planner, or that free calendar from your insurance guy and examine how you've spent your time in the past week and month. How many hours can you assign to each of the life priorities you identified? Where have you successfully aligned your values with your time? Where do you find gaps between what you preach and what you actually practice? This exercise can keep you honest and help you steer your days toward a more meaningful life. One final exercise. Picture yourself at 90. Longevity is increasing, and many of us will now live into our 90s. Set aside a half hour to picture yourself at age 90 and to put yourself in the mind of 90-year-old you. What does your life look like when you view it from that vantage point? What have you accomplished? What have you contributed? What are your regrets? This isn't an easy exercise, neither intellectually nor emotionally, but it can be enormously valuable, and it can help you satisfy one of Viktor Frankl's most powerful imperatives. Live as if you were living for the second time and had acted as wrongly the first time as you are about to act now. Afterward. We've covered a lot of ground together, and I hope your experience listening to A Whole New Mind has been as enjoyable as mine creating it. As you prepare to step into the conceptual age, let me leave you with some parting thoughts. As I explained in Chapter 3, your future will depend on your answers to three questions. In this new era, each of us must look carefully at what we do and ask ourselves. 1. Can someone overseas do it cheaper? 2. Can a computer do it faster? 3. Am I offering something that satisfies the non-material, transcendent desires of an abundant age? These three questions will mark the fault line between who gets ahead and who gets left behind. Individuals and organizations that focus their efforts on doing what overseas knowledge workers can't do cheaper and computers can't do faster, as well as on meeting the aesthetic, emotional, and spiritual demands of a prosperous time, will thrive. Those who ignore these three questions will struggle. It seems clear then that the conceptual age is dawning, and that those who hope to survive in it must master the high concept, high touch abilities I've described. This situation presents both promise and peril. The promise is that conceptual age jobs are exceedingly democratic. You don't need to design the next iPhone or discover a new source of renewable energy. There will be plenty of work, not just for inventors, artists, and entrepreneurs, but also for an array of imaginative, emotionally intelligent, right-brain professionals, from counselors to massage therapists to school teachers to stylists to talented salespeople. What's more, as I've tried to make clear, the abilities you'll need – design, story, symphony, empathy, play, and meaning – are fundamentally human attributes. They are things we do out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. They reside in all of us and need only be nurtured into being. The peril is that our world moves at a furious pace. Computers and networks grow faster and more interconnected each day. China and India are becoming economic behemoths. Material abundance in the advanced world continues to grow. That means that the greatest rewards will go to those who move fast, the first group of people who develop a whole new mind, who master high concept and high touch abilities, will do extremely well. The rest, those who move slowly or not at all, may miss out or, worse, suffer. The choice is yours. This new age fairly glitters with opportunity, but it is as unkind to the slow of foot as it is to the rigid of mind. I hope this audiobook provides you with the inspiration and the tools you'll need to make your journey. I'd like to hear about your experiences. If you have a story to tell or an exercise to recommend, let me know. You can reach me at dpp@danpink.com. Meantime, thanks for listening. Good luck in the age of art and heart.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of A Whole New Mind by Daniel H. Pink. Copyright 2005 by Daniel H. Pink. Read by the author. Directed and engineered by Chris Berry. Music composed by Michael Wayland. Performance copyright 2008 by Audible, Inc. All rights reserved. Published by Brilliance Audio. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. And please visit audible.com to discover over 50,000 titles available for download to the Apple iPod, BlackBerry, and hundreds of other MP3 players and mobile devices. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.